This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
From athletic stuff like a full court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff like a half mile stroll. Get those steps in. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
This episode of the Sportsman's Nation is brought to you by Outdoor Edge and their complete lineup of replaceable and fixed blade knives and game processing kits. Now, in my bag this year, I had the Razor Pro Saw Combo Kit. It comes in a very compact, handy carrying case, and one handle has the replaceable blade knife and the gutting blade. The other handle has the saw that comes with it. So I use the saw to split the pelvis, and I use the gut hook to open up the cavity and the blade to start cutting all the stuff out, right? So it makes cleaning a deer very simple, very easy, and the knife is sharp. And if you've ever had to gut a deer with a dull knife, we all know how much that sucks. So take a look at the Razor Pro Saw Combo Kit and head on over to OutdoorEdge.com and enter the discount code NATION30. That's NATION30 for 30% savings on your purchase.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
Hey guys, welcome back to Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam, Keith,
Matt Dye is here,
and we're going to open up in part number two of our Prescribed Fire series. As we're kind of amping up into February today, recording February 6th, this is like podcast 285, Prescribed Fire, burning in the timber. We've got a bunch of different parts. I don't even think we've completely composed exactly how many parts of this series we're going to have, because we're going to have to get into another series on our other podcasts this week, or not this week, but sometime soon. But we're going to have Kyle and Frank come on and discuss a lot of things that they've used Prescribed Fire. That one's going to be pretty in-depth and going to be jam-packed with great information. But Matt and I are going to cover something today that is one of the probably the most talked about forms of Prescribed Fire that we cover. But before we get into that, we want to bring back the workshops, Habitat Workshops. Oh, yeah. We launched those last week, put them on our store, and we've had great feedback. A lot of guys discussing and telling us they're going to see us there. I've had some orders come through. We're going to be in Michigan. Matt, you got the dates?
Not in front of me right now. Okay. But I believe it's June 23rd through the 25th.
And then July 25th through the 27th, I believe.
That's I'm sorry, we had that backwards. June 25th through the 27th. That makes July 23rd through the 25th in Alabama, and then the June date is in Michigan.
Yep, so one of them is just south of Birmingham, 45 minutes. The other one is just west of Grand Rapids in Michigan. So we're going to be up there for you guys in the north and down south for you guys over in Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia area. So, and I will say, Matt, because I've had a couple guys ask, like, what in the world? One guy asked in particular, he's like, you guys are in Missouri and you can't even have a workshop. This is just a start. We're planning on doing several workshops, hopefully multiple workshops every single year. This first year, we may add more dates, but we didn't because we're still kind of playing out the pandemic, which states are going to be open, which states are going to be closed, trying to find the appropriate farms. We're not going to be a workshop where you always come to us. We are trying to make them regionally based so we can hit those areas. So if you're like, Lan, I don't really want to travel to Michigan, maybe hold off because we may be coming. We may add a date this summer that's closer. Every one of them is going to be a little different because obviously there's different things, different management techniques that are going to happen in Michigan that are going to happen down south, and totally different stress periods. So those are going to be different, a different approach. So we're looking forward to it, but know that there's going to be more in the future. You know, we are doing the NDA, formerly QDMA habitat module in northern Missouri. That's in June, right, Matt?
That is. That would be June 11th through the 12th in North Missouri. So that one's actually a kind of a deal with NDA and ONAX, and we're going to be doing hunting property evaluations. So basically start to finish of how we evaluate a property. This is a really neat farm, a lot of cool aspects to it. But even our workshops that will be in Michigan and Alabama, you know, we want us specifically to come to your region so we could teach you in let's say, your habitat, what makes sense to you guys, not always just come to Missouri. But like Adam said earlier, we're going to be floating around. This is just year one of workshops. So if we're not quite close enough to you, hopefully the next year we'll be there in your region, but we will be moving around the country and hitting different regions kind of strategically. But for first year, this is what we're going to roll with. And so far the response has been good. I've been very happy with people signing up and getting on board. So hopefully we'll see everyone there.
Yep, for sure. Also, shout out to First Light, who helps make this podcast happen every single week. First Light, guys, if you haven't tried it, looked them up, figured out kind of what makes them different, you need to. Matt and I have been wearing it now for a couple of seasons, and I know we couldn't be happier. A lot of really awesome. We're wearing a lot of it during the consulting season as well. Mm-hmm. And I can officially say the Buckhorn pants are phenomenal. Sawbucks.
Sawbucks, yes.
Sawbucks.
Great pants.
Amazing. Briar pants. Man, I've been wearing them now and several consults.
Here's the thing, though, too. You say briar pants, but, you know, like when I was young growing up, like when I got into a pair of briar pants or, you know, like built-in chaps into the pants, it was always like, oh man, these are like stiff and I can't like hardly walk. When I get out of them, it's like, all right, cool, I'm putting like jeans back on. These though aren't that at all. They're super comfortable and they're not like overly stiff,
yeah,
but they're protective at the same time. Yeah, it's a really great combination.
I honestly would think about, feels like a corrugate pant with the briar, a stiffer front. And I honestly, now I'm looking at going, you know, maybe I'm going to get rid of these corrugate pants and just get more Sawbucks.
Because they're not heavy.
No, no.
But, man, they're just all around a fantastic pant for outside working and walking. I love them.
Yeah. So check them out at firstlight.com. Okay.
Yes. Prescribed fire follow-up. You know, last week, Adam, we talked about all the tools you needed to get started with prescribed fire. And I hope that was a good foundation, you know, to build off of for the coming weeks, because most people think, oh my gosh, fire, you got to have all this and that. And really the tools are very simple. So if you didn't pick up on that last week, make sure you go back and download that podcast, write down the list. And really, that's the tools that we use to burn with and how we would be approaching a timber burn, which is what we're talking about this week. I think, Adam, though, it's very important to talk about the various goals that someone may have when they're trying to burn their timber.
Yes.
So, yes. If you will, what would be like in the top kind of three goals most people, most landowners would fall into if they were burning their timber?
Well, I think a lot of times people would say, I want to burn the timber because I want to create, I know I need to burn. A lot of people are like, I know I need to burn. A lot of people tell me I need to burn. And I mm-hmm. think a lot of them burn for the very reason that you and I probably don't burn as much. But a lot of them think I need to burn to kind of control the brush.
Right.
And then at the same time, I need to burn because I know it's good for the wildlife.
Yeah.
And for so those are the typical ones that I hear a lot from landowners and listeners and interactions on social media. I think for me, a big part, I'll say my goals for burning timber are promote more understory growth, control invasives, or at least knock them back,
mm-hmm.
and improve diversity of mm-hmm. my acreage. And by
yes.
improving, I guess, title of that last one, improved diversity, would be promote not only herbaceous forbs, but grasses, sedges, shrubs, but also oak regeneration. And that
yes.
is very much a fine tune where you can't burn too often, but you need to burn some to try to encourage that next generation of oaks to grow.
Absolutely.
And so those are my goals, the big three.
Yeah, no, that's definitely hits a lot of the good points, I think, that we need to bring up when we're talking about burning timber, because I think a lot of people use it, I would say for the wrong goals or the wrong purposes. Like you said early on, was they want to clean up the brush, where we really are on the exact opposite side of the spectrum, saying, no, I want to promote a denser understory. I want that to come back. And we'll get into this later on, but that also is a function of how much sunlight's getting in. Not necessarily we just clean it up. And and a lot of other people are like, well, I've got a lot of leaves and I'm just going to burn and reduce the tick habitat and this and that. And it's like, okay, that shouldn't be the only purpose of burning. Like if that's the goal, you've missed the point of burning all the other benefits that you can have with a functional fire. And I think the other aspect is that people kind of misunderstand with fire, though. And we talked a little bit about last week how fire doesn't really discriminate, right? If it's burning through something, usually it just kind of moves or goes around something, you know, whatever. It doesn't really discriminate. But I think that would make people think that fire is a very general, broad tool. But however, the timing and then the way you apply fire to the landscape can be a very fine tool. Like you can do a lot of, let's say, detail work with it if it's applied appropriately.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, it has this broad spectrum feel if you want to utilize it that way, but you can also get very detailed and utilize fire in different ways as you get more advanced. And I think, honestly, when people continue to listen to the podcast series, especially when Kyle and Frank will talk about it, they'll pick up on that. They'll pick up and say, oh, wow, this isn't just like all my 50 acres I burned in this one unit is, okay, it's all black, it's all burned. Like, it doesn't have to just be like burnt. You know what I mean? Like, there's much finer points throughout that 50 acres that you could use the fire for. But so what were the three goals again?
So I want to improve diversity. I want to control invasives.
Yep.
And I also want to What was that third one?
I think you said promote an understory.
Yeah, promote.
And then I think the fourth one, or maybe 3B, would have been promote oak regeneration.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Promote. So yeah, and so I want to say something before I forget, since we're just at the beginning, for the guys listening and that are like, oh, I'm gonna burn, and you guys are all excited. Here is one thing that I've had to stress over and over and over and over and over. It's just constant. If you haven't done any thinning in the timber, if you haven't done any bedding thickets, micro clear cuts, and your timber areas or even a specific timber unit has not been thinned, so it's for the most part 80% or more closed canopy, fire probably shouldn't be used there first.
I would say that's not the first phase of the project, right?
No.
I think you could be very disappointed with the results. And we see this so much. Like, again, fire is a great tool, but it needs to fall, let's say, in place or more or in order of different steps throughout the habitat management process. It's not like necessarily if you have 100% closed canopy, your introductory tool to say, I'm making a giant improvement, because with no sunlight, you don't get that regeneration. That's the big point of utilizing prescribed fires, diversifying and creating that rich understory that lots of wild game can benefit from, but really just burning off leaf litter, man, that doesn't have much result when you have 100% or close to 90 plus percent closed canopy. That it's, yeah, just
you're almost bliss. If your goals are improved cover, improved forage, and you're burning on a 2 to 3 year burn rotation and it's closed canopy, you're ultimately hurting. You're taking steps away from reaching, mm-hmm, your goals. You're headed the other direction.
It is creating, and it's not permanent, but it is creating a park-like setting.
Yeah.
Like, literally, all it is, and I'm air quoting, like, that type of practice would be cleaning things up. And I say that facetiously. It's really just decreasing the habitat value if you don't feed that system afterwards and you feed it with light.
Yeah.
And you know, this is one of the questions, you know, later on in the podcast, but it's come up early, right? One of the big questions I get, or we get, let's just say, through social media is like, should I do TSI before or after I burn? Like, that always comes up. And, you know, people are kind of sometimes worried about, you know, the debris, right? The treetops, the trees down on the ground, will fire work? Will it carry through there? It'll be too hot, too much fuel. So while we're on it, I think we ought to just hit that question. And give our old famous answer. It depends.
Yeah, for sure.
I think it really does depend on what is the prescription. What is the how dense are you going, or you know how heavy
what
of an
time of the year is it?
Yeah,
are
absolutely.
You in the middle of if deer season's over and it's December and you're like, you know what, I've got some time. Should I burn it now? I'd say no. Run a chainsaw for a month, right, and a half, and then burn it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But if it's early March and you're like, I'd like to burn it, I'd say burn it and then come back in the summer and start. Or if you're, you know, if you don't really want to get it after it runs a chainsaw during the summer, then burn it and then come back in the next winter and TSI it. Like, it's really, yep, just I would say there's no wrong way as long as the work is done.
I would say as long as both steps happen. I don't get super picky about the order necessarily.
Yeah.
Because it's like, wow, we've seen results of thinning, and no follow up prescribed fire. Sure, it's decent, but it's like, man, that wood lot or those acres need fire bad. It's kind of like the whole, you know, clear cut thing, right? It's really great for 5, 6, 7 years, and it's like, go. Oh, nothing happened. So now it's kind of crummy. Now, yeah, now we have a mess on our hands.
Now we're talking, like, either we gotta mulch it up, we gotta run chainsaws,
we may
have to spray it. There's some sort of major labor when we could have just hit it 2 years after it was clear cut with a fire and kept it at bay.
Again, it's a multi-step process. Fire is fantastic, but it for you to get a result that you want, there's got to be sunlight either already coming into that area, or you cut it and, you know, you burn it, and then right afterwards you add the sunlight to get that response. Either way, let's talk about timing of burns, specifically timber burns.
Yep.
A lot of theories, a lot of different ways to, let's say, skin the cat. But
timing of burning timber, there's so much. I think the two categories that most people think of in burning would be growing season or dormant season. I'm going to burn in the winter. I'm going to burn in the summer. And if I know that, I'll probably get an email or a social media message that says, no, you're wrong about that. But in my experience, if it is dry enough to burn timber during the growing season, it is red flag. And I can, if I do not know what I'm doing, I can top kill and damage a lot of timber.
Yes.
And so for me, and I believe wholeheartedly that you can manage for timber value and have wildlife. Now, you can't go 100% for timber and 100% for wildlife. You have to understand
there's give and
you
take.
Gotta, you got, there's give five. And take there, but I definitely think that you can do it. Now, I would say that burning in your timber, 9 times out of 10, for a successful burn, it needs to be burned during the dormant season. Anywhere from January, even December on certain instances, but December through whenever spring green up happens.
Yeah, in your respective area. And I certainly agree with that. There's probably very few instances where, you know, in a timbered unit, I want to stress timbered unit, because we burnt last year in a very mixed, open to a couple, you know, couple trees in late August. Yeah. And the goal there certainly was not timber, and wasn't to kill any of the big trees that were in there, but it was literally to set back woody aggression underneath some of those. Yep. And, but in a timber stand, I would certainly rely more heavily on the dormant season. And I know we'll talk about it throughout this podcast, but we've had many instances in the last couple of years where we're really pushing that envelope of getting to that first little portion of beginning of green up, just for the fact of, one, the weather cooperated, and then two, there's different goals and objectives on that specific burn unit that we wanted to really kind of push the envelope and get, have some things kind of greening up a little bit before we went and used fire. So in regard to the seasons, dormant season,
it's pretty much
December, March, April is pretty much the focus for a timbered unit burn to achieve what you want without risking anything from a value killing
now, trees. I'll say timing also for the difference between, and I'm going to lump two slopes together and the other two together, but east and north slopes versus south and west slopes. East and north can typically have more moisture, better timber, because of more moisture. And so therefore bigger trees, more canopy, more moisture, all the things that say my burn window, the window of time to get a successful burn on those north slopes and east slopes is a lot smaller than south slopes and west slopes. So typically if I'm planning on burning a unit that is that's dominant by north slope or east slope, then I will try to burn more in the dormant season. And I'll explain the difference between dormant season and or dormant versus dormant and a little closer to spring green up. But
double dormant.
You double dormant. I'm talking December, January, early February for those north slopes. And I'm talking I can go December through even early April. And here in southern Missouri, it may change a little bit. Down south, it may not be early April. It may be early March because green up happens earlier. But in west facing and south facing, we do it almost every year where there's starting to be some trees pushing and greening up. There's some undergrowth that's already greening up. But because it's catching more sun, it is definitely able to dry out so we can carry a fire. So if I've got multiple burn units planned, I'm going to try to burn those north and east facing slopes earlier in the winter or earlier in the spring, and then do my west and south ones closer to green up.
And you know, if you are in an area that has a lot of topography changes, yeah, of course, one burn unit may encompass all of those slopes. We're just talking preferential here. And if I have units that are primarily north and east, do them earlier. They take the priority over the south and west. You can burn those much later into the season, comparatively speaking. But like around here, again, one unit or 30 acres probably has aspects on a lot of different slopes, right? Because just, hey, we're in an area that's got quite a bit of topography. But so explain the dormant and dormant.
Yeah. So basically when I say dormant, I'm meaning like that December, January where there's nothing greening up. The only thing you'll find are very small buds forming on some of your trees. But dormant, but still close to growing season. I mean, like fescue's greening up. It's that window of time in March and early April. Even up in the northern part of the country, it may be early May. And that time frame, although it is dormant season, there's more moisture typically because we start getting those spring rains. And so, like, if you're banking on burning a north slope in that window of time where things start greening up, I would say 9 times out of 10 or 8 times out of 10, you're going to have a very patchy burn, which isn't all bad. But if your goal is to really get that break-to-break burn, you probably won't have it.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's wet seams, little seeps out of hillsides.
It's going to be a smoky fire.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to simmer. It's going to probably be very slow. But, again, patchy burn, really not that bad for wildlife.
Yeah.
So we talked about the timing of burns and specifically for timber units. Mm-hmm. A lot of people also ask, okay, if it's timber, then how in the world do I establish a fire line? Yeah. And I think a lot of people may say, I have a road over here on this portion of the property. I've got a creek and a field edge. But really, guys, like, I'm just trying to get started burning. And that's 100 acres. Like, I can't burn 100 acres. I wouldn't feel comfortable burning 100 acres. And I think that's where what hangs up a lot of people is they think, man, I have these fire breaks that I can't really break it up or do smaller portions or patches. But in all reality, we cut our own fire line a lot. And sure, we're going to use what makes sense from a field edge and a road system standpoint, but sometimes you just don't have those options.
Yeah.
And you got to create your own fire break, and there's multiple ways of doing that. I think that's a big hang up for people. They're like always worried about the size and, oh, it doesn't even matter if I do, you know, 2, 3, 5 acres. It's like, well, it certainly isn't going to hurt, you know.
Yeah.
try something. But how do you establish a fire line? What is the desired end result of a fire break?
Yeah. You know, in timber for us, the main farm we've been working on is fortunately got a lot of four-wheeler trails. And so basically if you've got a farm that's got a lot of those four-wheeler trails, it's take a backpack blower and blow the leaves out of it and get it down to bare soil, or bare rock if you're here in the Ozarks. And so that's a quick way. But if there's no line established, there's no trail established, one of the quickest ways that you can establish a fire line in the timber would be a man running a chainsaw and a man running a backpack blower. And the guy in the front running the chainsaw, he just cuts all the little saplings or brush about the size of a, you know, 5 foot, 5 foot wide trail, a little hiking trail.
Yep.
Picture those state parks or national forests that you've been on where there's hiking trails and you're just like, everybody walks the same one, but you can see that it's about 3 foot wide of bare ground, but then 3 or 4 foot wide bare ground, and then there's another foot on each side or 2 foot that's been trampled vegetation. That's about, I mean, that's awesome. I mean, that's ideal. I would rather have about 5 foot of bare ground, but you can certainly burn off of a trail like that. So put a guy in the front running chainsaw, and he's cutting everything off as close to the ground as he can get without ruining a chain on the chainsaw and dulling it up on rocks. And then he's kind of kicking stuff out. And then the second guy, ideally you've got three guys, but the second guy is kind of doing the 80 grit leaf blowing, and he's kind of knocking the majority of them off. Yeah, he's knocking the top off, and he's kicking the sticks out of the way. And the third guy is 220 grit, and he's finishing it off. And, I mean, you can, if you got three guys who are just good workers, you can build a lot of line very quickly in closed canopy timber. If you're in kind of that woodland setting where you've got a bunch of brambles and grass and all stuff, yeah, it might take a little longer. You may have to throw a weed eater man in the mix. But if we're talking burning timber, that's the way. One guy running chainsaw, one guy running backpack blower. And
it is amazing how fast that can fly.
And then I would say this would be my advice. Once you get that trail cut, keep it open with four-wheeler. Like, make sure you're running that trail, if it's doable, not steep as a horse's face. You know, run a four-wheeler on it multiple times in the year so it doesn't grow back in vegetation. Maybe even throw your herbicide sprayer on when you're spraying food plots and spray all the vegetation that's trying to grow back up in it and establish it as a four-wheeler trail. Doesn't have to be one you drive in to hunt. Doesn't have to be one you're driving to check your trail cameras. But make sure you keep it open, because once you get it established, it should be there for many, many years to come.
It's just going to cut down the time and maintenance it's going to take to get fire ready. And I think the other thing to keep in mind too is when you are clearing out the fire line itself and you're creating it, let's just say you're walking down, you know, south to north through a piece of timber, and you're burning everything to the east or to your right. Throw the debris to your left. Don't build up, you know, whether it's a treetop or a couple shrubs or blow in all your leaves. Don't blow it into the fire unit itself. Blow all the leaf and the litter to the left outside of the fire break. So you don't have this buildup of fuel right adjacent to your line. That's going to be basically more fuel than what you're going to burn interior right there adjacent to your actual fire break. So move everything to the left or the west of the unit itself. And that way you're reducing that fuel load.
For sure. For sure.
And be watching for snags. So when you're creating those fire breaks, someone with a chainsaw or really anybody who is looking around on that line, keep your eye out from the interior of that unit.
If you had the time, my advice would be to say, if you've got the time, make it a couple of passes. So man running chainsaw, all he's doing is picking the trail, trying to go in a straight line as much as possible. Anytime you run jags or sawtooths in a line, there's a better chance of a spot or a fire to ignite on the other side of the fire break and be in the unit you don't want to burn. That's called a spot. So try to keep them straight, and as if you're going to have angles, make them as swayed as possible, where they're very gradual and you don't do those sawtooths. And so that man running chainsaw, he's just picking the trail and he's cutting it out. He's the trailblazer.
There you go.
And then the second guy is blowing it out. Once you get done, I would prefer to do the next walkthrough. Like, maybe you walk back, or you get on a four-wheeler and you drive it, and that's when you check for snags. Because I have been on fire where you're trying to check for snags and run and build the actual line and you miss some. So if you have the time, do that.
And there's two ways you can clean out around snags. One, if you know which direction and fell it, and you can, or you can control where you're felling that tree, fell it, just cut it, put it on the ground, or take the leaf blower and blow out a good 3 foot at least wide swath around the base of that tree where it's not going to burn. Move all the leaves just like you would with the fire break around from that. And you don't have to really worry about it catching down the road or when you're burning that unit itself. Just get it gone or cut it flat on the ground.
Yep, 100%.
So We've got fire breaks. Another way, a lot of people, especially down south, there's a lot of forestry roads, so the road systems are in place. Or it's not uncommon for people to bring in and have small dozers or skid steers prepping that fire line ahead of time too. That's some big machinery, big equipment. You certainly don't have to go to that degree. Again, we just talked about 5 foot break of the timber. We burn off that all the time. Mm-hmm. But those are other options. And from a cost sharing option too, through the NRCS and EQIP programs, you can get paid to put in permanent fire breaks. There actually we had two clients here local this past late summer flagged out fire breaks, aka road systems, and they now have cost shared road systems, permanent fire breaks around their boundaries of their property, and will be burning off of them this year. And so that was done with the dozer. So they can have, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword there. Boundary road system to be able to run up and down. Plus, they have beautiful fire breaks that are going to be maintained and opened up for a long time. Huge, huge asset to be able to use that. Basically, again, lifetime of fire breaks created for you and help to get paid for.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, so running with a back chainsaw, backpack blower, hand line, as we call them, and everybody mm-hmm. in the history of the world and governments called them hand lines. And then you've got, you know, doze lines or skidder lines. So another way to establish, if you are doing a timber harvest, have some forethought and have your timber crew making these skidder trails where they're hauling the logs out in the areas that you want to establish fire breaks.
Yes.
And so they can do a lot of the work, and you just have a little bit of cleanup and boom, you've got a great established fire break or a road system. So that's another wonderful way.
Definitely. So we've got the goals, we got the timing, we got how to establish, covered the tools last week. What about conditions for prescribed fire in the timber? What kind of weather conditions would be ideal? And again, guys, there's a variance here. A balance, but we're going to kind of set the stage from an ideal, man, I'd like to see this 3-day forecast ahead of my Saturday when I've got guys who said, hey, put me on call for fire. I want to do it. What does that look like?
So for me, one of the two biggest things for selecting weather conditions to burn in timber would be, wind speed and amount of sun.
Yes.
You know, there's some other factors. Humidity would also have a huge role, but if I don't have sun, even though it may be down around 40% humidity, if it's mix of partly sunny and cloudy, I'm like, ha, I need sun. So I'm going to select having full sun or at least a large, like mostly sunny weather forecast with wind no more than 15 miles an hour.
I mean, cloud cover, that percentage, that's where on the weather graph we talked about last week with on NOAA, it's super
weather.gov.
Important to be watching that. Yeah,
yep.
It's super, super important to be watching what the percentage is, because you might start out with a cloudy morning or a heavier dew, but then it burns off at, you know, 11 o'clock, sun comes out, but it's been windy all day. Really, it dries out and you're putting flame on the ground at 1 o'clock and then it stays sunny. Or you could have the exact opposite. You get up and you're like, wow, it looks like a great burn day. Feels like a great burn day. And then clouds roll in and it just absolutely shuts it down.
Yeah.
And that stuff happens. But in an ideal world, you want sun.
Yeah. I'm looking at, you know, I just went to weather.gov, plugged in my hometown, not far from the family farm, and I plugged it in and I looked at fire weather. So I went to the graph in the bottom right, and then I went to the chart and fire weather, and I clicked the four box, mixing height, Haynes index, transition, wind, and vent rate. And so I'm looking and, you know, over the next few days, I see, you know, like tomorrow the wind will be 9 miles an hour. Humidity, the lowest it gets is 60, almost 60%. No, tomorrow's not a burn day. But if I scroll down, I look at the fire weather on down. Haynes Index is a 3, which I said last week I would like it to be a 4. And then the ventilation rate is very low. And so I'm knowing that, you know, and then the mixing height is a very, you know, it's not a very high ceiling. And it's a very, it's a low ceiling, and my ventilation rate is very low in miles per hour. So it would be very smoky fire if I attempted it. Tomorrow would be an unsuccessful fire.
Correct.
Yeah. So what ideally I'm looking for, humidity in the 30s or 40s, wind speed 8 to 14 miles an hour, Haynes index of 4, and a, you know, I'd like to see a ceiling height or a mixing height of over 30,000 or 3,000 feet is what I would like to see it. I'd see, like to see it so I know that smoke's getting out of there. And then, of course, the ventilation rate being somewhere around 3,000 as well. So,
and I think this is the other side of things that people can this is kind of where the common sense kicks in. If you ever have experience in burning, you can walk outside and physically feel the days that burn. You know, when it comes to late January, February, when it's been windy for a couple days or sun's been out and you're walking and it's just super loud and crunchy, that means that the actual fine fuels, the leaves and all the everything else, you know, the leaves that are kind of mulched up underneath, they're going to burn. And that means they're dry and ready, crispy for action. But you also feel it, like you said, on your lips, right? I mean, you can feel the dryness of the air. Your lips get chapped, the breeze. And you can kind of almost feel the sun on those days too, really kind of beating out. If you got full sun, those conditions mixed together probably is going to be a really, really good fire day. But obviously don't just base it off that. Do your homework. Know what the weather's going to be like. Know if there could be changes throughout the day before you put fire on the ground. But you can tell it when you walk outside what days are going to burn.
For
what
sure.
What days are not going
to
burn.
Once you train yourself to look for that, mm-hmm. know what you're looking for, you can definitely say, oh, yeah, today's a day for it to burn.
That's exactly right. You know, the other thing that people really get, I would say, hung up on, and we're going to cover these in crazy detail because these are some of the points that Kyle and Frank are going to really hit home and talk in detail about, but different firing techniques that someone could use in the timber. You know, backing fire, flanking fire, and stripping fires are all different techniques that someone could utilize. Most, you know, it's not very common that a lot of people will use a head fire in their timber, but a backing fire, and I'm kind of describe what that is in as layman's terms as possible, how someone would go about utilizing a backing fire in February in a thinned canopy unit.
So backing fire typically is backing into the wind. So it's burning and it's moving into the wind. So it's a lot slower fire. Flame heights are a lot smaller, but it's relatively more controlled, or gives the impression that it's more under control. It can change in a matter of seconds of being a controlled fire versus uncontrolled fire. But that's kind of the idea, is that you have a fire that is, let's say, just picture a box and the wind is moving from the west to the east. You light on the east side of the unit and it burns to the west. So it's burning into the wind. That's a backing fire.
It's essentially, think of it like going against the grain, right? Fire normally would want to be carried either uphill or with the wind, but we're doing the opposite, and we're basically utilizing the existing conditions to keep the fire in control as much as possible. Yeah. A lot of times you're going to use a backing fire regardless to some degree on any fire as you're starting it. Even if you end up doing a ringing fire or a head fire at some point, you started with a backing fire as you were putting in, let's say, the black line around the fire.
Yeah. And so what I would say, this is where some confusion may happen. So I'll try to be as clear as possible. My wife may say that's going to be impossible for me to do, but so I described a fire moving from east to west as a backing fire. You can throw that out if there's terrain, because mm-hmm. terrain overrides the wind, and so especially steeper terrain like here in the Ozark Mountains. So if I light at the bottom of a hill, I'm creating a head fire. If I light at the top of the hill, I'm creating a backing fire. And so correct. That basically, because if you light at the bottom of the hill, that fire, as it cooks, it's preheating that fuel uphill, so it can move much faster. So
drying everything out.
A very dangerous fire is a slope, a west-facing slope, and you light at the bottom of the hill with a west-facing wind, or with a west wind. So you've got the wind and the elevation. Those are fires that are very scary, and that's what happens out west a lot. So if I'm burning in the timber and I'm typically trying to shoot for a backing fire, then I'm going to light on the uphill side and let it back down the slopes.
If you think about it, again, it's going against the grain, right? If everyone knows heat rises, but if I'm starting at the top of the hill and heat is rising, all that heat is going away from the fuel that's basically in line to be burned next, which is down the slope.
Yeah.
So literally it is in most cases creeping down the slope. And so just to paint the picture, let's just say we just started and we're putting the black line around our fire, which is basically starting on a fire break and we're letting it burn down away from the fire line. So we basically have the 5 foot of the fire line plus another 10, 15, 20 yards of a black line into that unit. But that 10 to 15, 20 yard time frame obviously depends on fuel loads and everything. But let's just say, you know, it could easily take 20 minutes for it to go that far off your the place you started, the fire break line itself, to go 20 yards into the timber. It's literally not like this anything that's racing and running across the ground. It is a slow process, or can be a slow process, to get started and create that backing fire off the line. I think, again, a lot of people are like, they're cautious of the fire, which is a great thing to be with little experience, but that backing fire tends to be a very slow process because, right, we're going against the grain of things. We're going down the slope, but we're also going in or I guess to say, into the wind.
Yep.
So what about a flanking fire? What does flanking mean?
So it's like a right angle
mission.
I guess my best way of saying it is it's like the right angle fire where it's not burning, you're not lighting it into the wind, or so it's going to burn against the wind or into the wind. It's lighting it perpendicular with the wind. And a lot of times these are used in a way to speed up a backing fire or to feed a backing fire more, because mm-hmm. flames are attracted to flames, or flames are attracted to heat. And so
yes.
if you were to, it's the same kind of concept with a stripping fire when you're trying to attract flames and allow them to build up. Because if you light a backing fire and it's moving very slow, like, man, this is just not burning as quickly as I'd like, you can go and light a 30-yard strip to try to create a micro, try to change the atmosphere there to where you've kind of a micro climate, if you will, to where that fire senses that other fire, and immediately both those flames get bigger because they can sense each other and they rush to each other. And that's a way to build up a fire and burn things that may be burning too slow for your choosing.
And that's the thing of, like,
this is trying to talk and describe something that physically you cannot see, right? But like when there is fire in the air, it is changing, you know, how oxygen is working there, and oxygen fuels that fire. So when you have flames and then you drop below and you flank that original fire, those two separate fires react to each other because of oxygen, and yeah. Now we've created a little bit of a more intenser situation.
Yeah,
but we're not head firing anything. We've just created and added more fire in this area to speed up the process, or potentially pull that backing fire into a different area.
Yeah. So I guess
it's like a magnet. If you
I haven't described it very clearly yet, so I would say that. Picture you've got that square again. You've got, you know, a perfect 40-acre unit, and the wind is out of the west again, and you're on the eastern side, and you've ran a backing fire. So it is just slowly creeping through the timber, moving west into the wind, and it's moving too slow. So I immediately go, you know what? I need to speed things up. And we have typically, the one we use more is a stripping fire, which we'll say here in a second. But flanking fire would be like, all right, the heck with this. And I grab my drip torch, and I walk straight into the wind for 30 yards. And I do that, lighting straight towards the wind. So my fire moves off. And it's instead of moving parallel with my backing fire that I lit, it starts to spread off going north and south, and then it can catch that wind and head fire a little bit, but doesn't really have the full force or the full line east to west or north to south to really strip back and slam into my backing fire. So it's a way to speed up the process. Yeah.
It was a single line.
Yeah.
That you pulled further off of basically your backing fire would have been in north and south.
Yeah.
That came off the east line, right?
Yep.
But what you did was pull a single line, drop fuel and flame, and went due west right against your backing fire.
Yeah, it's a little bit more severe than a backing fire, but it's not quite, and it's nowhere near as much severe as a head fire.
Correct.
So it may gain a little speed, but it's not going to gain full speed like a head fire, because it just is not, it does not have the angles correct to cause a head fire.
Absolutely. You described, I went on a straight line west in a single line. And so that was into the wind. But if you think about it, remember we talked about a heading fire, that would be going with the wind. But but if he walked from east to west, dropping fire in a single line, it's already black ahead of that fire.
Yeah.
When he stopped. So it's not like there can be much of a head fire because it's already burned because he was walking from east to west. So hopefully people are kind of picturing these directions and painting this picture in their head. But that should explain as to why it doesn't just rip and roar through there. Well, because it's already black, because he started in that direction.
Yep.
As he walked.
Yep. And then, of course, a stripping fire would be, I've got that same box, that 40-acre wood lot, and I light on the east side, and I'm backing it to the west with a west wind. I would walk in 10 yards from my backing fire and run another strip just exactly the way I lit it off the line to where those two fires suck together. And so I am creating a little head fire, but there's not enough space for the fuel to really build up or the flames to really get high and cause problems. So that is
you're
something.
Dropping below a big black line and then just letting it move, advance 10 yards at a higher rate to your black line. Your fire is meeting fire.
Yeah. And definitely, that's pretty much the main four that we use. So,
and that's, you know, to speed up a timber burn. And again, I don't want to at all play down fire, but we commonly use the stripping fire to speed things up, because sometimes it can be a long process. Yeah. And so we'll definitely use this on slopes to get things quite a bit faster. speed up the process.
Been here all day. Daddy's got to eat.
It might be burning, whether it's multiple units or it's just a bigger unit. That definitely is the goal, is to try and get things done just a little bit faster. Here's another situation, Adam. Let's say we've got a fire unit. Let's go back to that 40-acre unit. And let's just say in the very center of that 40 acres, we had a nice larger ridge that went out from the south, headed north, got almost to that northern boundary line. Someone says, okay, there's my 40 acres. How do I burn that in the timber? Like, how would you approach that situation from an ignition standpoint if you had that east and west, to east wind? You wouldn't go and start on that very far east side. How would you attack that with the addition of now we've got topography playing a role here?
Absolutely. So are you saying that, you know, if I was to look at it, there's one main ridge, and then the other two, like the one main ridge runs north to south, or south to north, right out of the center of it.
Right in the center.
And so that's the highest point. The east and west line are not very, there is no elevation there.
Correct.
Yeah.
They would be even equal. Let's just say there's a creek drainage on both sides. The east and west line are creek drainers, same elevation.
Yeah.
But if they hold kind of a big ridge in the center.
I would probably start, for me personally, I'd probably start running a line. I'd run a backing fire along my east side just because I want to always start on the very furthest point of where the fire unit. So just in case something happens, I don't have to worry about fire slamming into a line that's got no blacking. And so I would probably start there. Ideally, there's two lighters, two guys running drip torches, and they're running on the radio. And so one guy lights that east line, and he says, "Okay, I'm halfway done." And the guy on the top of the ridge lights and lets it back down that east facing slope towards that other eastern boundary where it's already been lit. So by the time the guy finishes up on the ridge, the guy on the east side's already knocked out the black line on the eastern side of the fire unit.
Mm-hmm.
So it would take those flames a while to back down that slope. Let's just say it's like at my family farm, it's about 250-foot elevation change. It's going to take a while to back down that slope. And it's going to take a while for that fire to creep across that flat ground. And so ideally you time it to where it backs down the slope and hits the bottom and starts, and then about that time the two lines merge together. At the same time, you're going to have that same fire that you lit across the spine of that ridge. It's going to be backing down that west facing slope as well. And so the whole time you've got guys on the north line, guys on the east line, and they're watching. And so that guy could easily turn and go, all right, when he walked from the south to the north, lighting the spot on that ridge, he turned and went west and kind of started lighting along that northern boundary, headed back west to kind of do a flanking fire. And, he's not going to get carried away. He's going to go 20 yards and he's going to monitor flame heights and the intensity of the fire. And if it goes pretty slow, he may walk another 30 yards and he may say, okay, this is behaving really well. I'm not damaging any trees. It's gaining some speed, but it's not killing anything or hurting anything. And he continues to progress 20 foot and 30 foot and on to the bottom of the hill. And he watches it and says, okay, that's pretty stinking good. And he's radioing back to the other guy. And the other guy says, okay, that looks really good. Everything looks like it's going well. And when he gets from the north to the south line, the very southeast corner of the unit, he could run and go along that southern boundary headed towards the spine of that ridge. And ultimately, when he gets done with that, somebody could go back and light that northeast part of that unit, and you've kind of created a backward C shape, and you've got fire in many places, multiple places, I should say. The spine of the ridge is backing down the slope, the east slope and the west slope, and the fire is going along the eastern boundary. Yep. And everybody's lost, but hopefully you visionaries, you men of vision, like, Captain Woodrow F. Call has. You men of vision have seen that perfectly. Because I did,
well,
in my head.
I'm right there with you. But hopefully, again, it's, you know, someone is like, oh, okay, paint the picture, or hey, let me restart that and try that illustration again in my head. But regardless, there's obviously certain ways when we throw topography into the mix that you would change the course of lighting necessarily. But it does. It's important to realize that topography does trump wind, but you still want to protect your boundary on that with a westerly wind. Still hit that east side first off.
Yep.
So another big question that people have is, what should I expect, like, when I am burning the timber? Let's say I'm just your typical kind of oak hickory forest, Midwest, Mid-Atlantic, kind of southern up to Ohio, let's just say the middle band of the U.S. When I'm burning timber, what's a flame height that I should relatively expect when I'm burning under the conditions that you mentioned before?
Anywhere from 6 to 16 inches is what I would shoot for, or 20 inches and under. You know, if I see anything get, when I start seeing it peak at about 20, I say, okay, whatever I just did, I want to make sure I don't get too carried away with that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you're getting that, I think that magic window is anywhere from 10 to 20 inches.
I was going to say that 12 to 18 inch flame height is going to be pretty dang good. Even keel throughout the whole deal. And that is another thing. You're going to hit pockets where, you know, you got a little bump in the elevation, or, you know, something changes, or you hit a pocket where a tree fell. And you've got brambles and stuff, and sure, it's going to jump up and it's going to, you know, kind of peak, but we're talking overall the course of things, you know, when you're backing off of your line, or it's just backing down a slope, that 10, 12, 18 inches is really where you want to be, kind of shoot for, let's say that be your gauge, how things are burning. And that kind of determines, your conditions too, because if you have cloud cover come over and you've got 18 inch flame height and it was, you know, super sunny, well, it's probably gonna fall to like 8 inches and sit there and just not fizzle out or anything, but just really just settle down.
Yeah,
and the sun pops back out and it's just gonna increase it up again.
Yeah,
so those little changes in the weather from, you know, 12 o'clock in the afternoon to 3 and 4. Drastically, you can see it, the fire react to those changes,
and that's
it's cool.
That's a great point about that, the changes in cloud cover, because let's picture you're burning and it is kind of partly cloudy, so you've kind of stepped up and got a little bit more aggressive with your lighting just to get the fire hot enough to really carry like you want, and all of a sudden the sun pops out. That's when you should buckle up and say, oh, let's tone it down and really watch, like, all right, blow the drip torches out. Let's watch this fire. Because that's when you can, in my experience, that's when spots happen. That's when snags start lighting up. That's when things happen that you go, uh-oh, Raggy, because we need to really make sure we don't do anything. And that's typically when I see a lot of people make errors, is you get aggressive because conditions aren't great, and then all of a sudden snap your fingers and the conditions are great, but you've lit in far too much that you can handle, and you're going, uh-oh.
Well, and
get ready
and
to jump some gullies, boys.
Why, as the person igniting with the drip torch, it's not keep your head down and just walk along the fire break. You really need to be aware of your surroundings and aware of the environment that you're burning. You need to look and see which way the fire is going, the flame heights, the wind direction just completely changes things. It's going to blow, you're going to notice it because it's going to blow smoke in your face or it's going to blow away. But as you're lighting, as you're stripping out additional places or you're going along your fire breaks, that is your job, you know. And I think it is people, I don't want to say that's necessarily being careless, but they just essentially will bite off more than what they can essentially protect along a fire break and watch closely. and when the wind kicks up or the sun pops back out, yeah, you might have a leaf or, you know, an ember pop across the line, and you can't run back 200 yards around the corner, and you can't monitor that. So you need to take things slow. And I think, again, it's just people get in trouble when they get cocky with it and aren't aware of their surroundings and basically bite off more than what they can chew.
Yeah.
And that's when things get questionable. But if you're cautious, if you're paying attention to these details and little tiny changes, then you're, like I say, you'll be safe, but you're doing what you should as someone who's igniting and watching this fire. And again, this goes back to the communication standpoint too. We talked about last week from having head boss. That's the person who has the most fire experience and can say, hey, all you other people out there, light, stop. We've had this change. Like, they need to be very clear and communicate that to everybody else of what's going on. Be aware of your surroundings. Hey, notice this. You know, sun's popping back out. Be careful, kind of thing.
Yep, absolutely.
The other big question is fire interval.
Yep.
And this is opening up a potentially bigger discussion. Obviously, fire return interval and the timing of your fires of the growing season versus dormant season really determines what type of plant communities are going to grow and what your fuel loads may be like. So let's just say,
and talk about your goals, because this is where it really gets critical.
And we prescribe different fire intervals all the time to different people. You know, last or 2 weeks ago, we were in Iowa. And I went straight to Georgia. And then you were in Indiana the week before. And next week, you'll be in Georgia. So it's like, when we start traveling and we're looking at different regions, and then we're looking at different plant communities that we'll expect to come back in each of these regions, and then how we want a certain portion of the property to look, well, our intervals are going to change drastically.
Yep.
I think from one region to another.
One of the big things would be have to identify, is this a unit that I'm growing timber? Because if I'm trying to grow timber, not just for myself, but for my kids or grandkids, then my interval is going to be backed off, not 2 to 4 years, but 5 to 10, maybe 7 to 15. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where a lot of guys may, especially, I think so many guys are messing up if they've got closed canopy hardwoods and they're burning on a 2 to 4 year interval.
Yeah.
And they're expecting that I don't have the oak regen. I wonder why. Well, first off, you're growing in a shady environment. It's closed canopy, so it's not great for oak regeneration. And you're burning. What few make it through, you burn them up.
I was out of sight the other day in kind of central western Georgia. And there was a beautiful piece of hardwoods. I mean, some really great trees in it, but it had not experienced fire in a while. It was 100% closed canopy, in this specific drainage, but what was getting, regenerated was tulip poplar and sweet gum.
Oh,
and no, none of the red oaks, none of the white oaks were regenerating, period. And it was wide open. The trees themselves were, there's some, you know, 28 inch DBH wide. I mean, just straight as an arrow, beautiful looking trees. But it's like, I asked the guys, like, you know, this looks, I'm air quoting, pretty, and these trees look pretty healthy. But what do you notice or what do you not notice? It took us a while. I was like, how many sweet gum saplings do you see? Where are all your oaks? What's the future? And I think that is a big question. It goes back to your goals. What's the purpose of you using fire in a specific unit? And then you will understand, or that fire return interval will become more clear to you. But in that specific site, closed canopy, no fire, there wasn't oaks coming back. It was sweet gums.
Yep.
And we see it all too often.
Yep. Yep. Species that can grow much faster and outcompete end up taking over if the intervals are wrong. And you know, that goes with almost every single thing we recommend. Is there's a lot of really good intentions and really yes. good plans that are 60 to 70% correct and or 60 to 70% effective. But it's that 30 to 40% which is the game changer.
Mm-hmm.
The difference in being mediocre and phenomenal. And yes. and I think so many times, like I really think that's a big part of our business is trying to get that additional 30-40% where it's like you were doing pretty good, but you weren't really making it awesome.
Well, and I think that's a fantastic point. I feel like this is between let's say doing FSI or cutting the timber and then burning. There's a lot of people out there who I won't say fall short, but they just don't quite do the project to the degree that they need to do it. And it's like, well, I'm using prescribed fire on my property, or I'm doing a little bit of chainsaw work, but it's always like, yeah, but the result is what I'm interested in. I'm glad that you're utilizing some of these techniques, but when we go and we walk, or you know, I ask it about what it is you're trying to create, and then we go and walk. The site didn't get there. We didn't do enough. We didn't add enough sunlight. We didn't cut hard enough, or you're burning too much in an area. And that can obviously be the case, but it's almost like just because you're utilizing some great tools doesn't mean you're using them necessarily right. And yeah. and we can tell because the site isn't responding the way we want it to, or the habitat, the plant communities aren't coming back or growing to the degree. We might have, you know, let's just say a sprig or two of little bluestem where really we wanted 20% of this pocket to be bluestem brand, you know, then of course have the brambles and other shrubs, but we just don't have the sunlight or yeah. you're burning too much, whatever it may be. Yeah. But it seems like that just is often the case with even again seasoned habitat managers or folks who are doing great techniques just potentially need that additional fine tuning tweaking.
Yeah. It's the fine tuned tweaking that can really just is oh, that's
when we've seen things just absolutely take off from it.
Yeah.
And it's not like, well, oh, you know, I'll go back to a consultation that Kyle Frank and I were on in Florida. Fantastic group of guys down there doing a lot of really good things, but literally one of the big suggestions was changing the fire interval, and then but more importantly there was changing the timing and kind of restructuring how they went about burning and placing priority in some areas and you know differences there, and I fully believe that that is going to really take that place, which is an extremely special place,
yeah,
to something greater and beyond.
Well, I'll give you another one.
That was simple. That yeah. was really simple.
How many times have we seen, you know, in the last few years, it seems like more and more people are doing these micro clear cuts and bedding thickets, and they mm-hmm. go in and they're like, okay, I'm going to cut in a pocket, you know, just a little ways away from my food plot. And that's going to be it.
Right.
But they don't cut enough. And so what they yes. do is they cut in and they say, wow, it's really thick and nasty in there. But they left too many trees standing. They hinge cut too many trees and not flush cut enough trees. And they yep. either, if they did all hinge cuts, they made it too thick. So deer only using the perimeter. And in 5 years, a lot of those hinge cuts are going to grow back up and be out of reach. Or they cut not enough and they left too many trees standing. And they get this huge influx of brambles. And depending on where you're at, it may be gooseberry or black raspberry or, in many cases, multiflora rose. Yes. And they're like, well, all I'm creating are briar patches. That's because you didn't promote enough sunlight. And so yes. you had good intentions, but you missed it. You missed the mark. And that's not a burn on you. It's just speaking advice on you got to make sure you do it right if you're really expecting phenomenal goals.
Yeah.
Or phenomenal results, I should say.
Yeah. What was that blackberry patch or the black raspberries or gooseberry or buckbrush that came back in because you're not getting enough light? Is it better? Is it denser? Does it offer more cover? Yes, yeah. It does. But on a scale from a 1 to 10, let's just say, or let's just give it a grade, a school grade, right, from A to an F of implementation, I'll give it a C or a D+. Not yeah. because I don't like you, but because literally we've seen in all these places what can happen. And yeah. it is more superior, but really you think about it, it's like, what does it take? If you get a 70% on a quiz, right? You got 70% right. But really to take it from average to great is only 30% difference. Yeah. And it's that 30% difference that really makes it that much more amazing. You did good work, but it isn't great work. And that's a smaller margin than getting it to good, right?
Yep.
So
yep.
I know C's get degrees, but man, everyone's looking for the A's.
Yep.
So
yeah, man.
One other quick thing I think people often worry with is the size of the burn. They think they have to go huge, big scale to make impacts and to get started. And, you know, a 3-acre burn, maybe you know, something that seems daunting to you. Well, if that's daunting to you, then burn an acre, burn half acre, do something. But
I would rather somebody burn 3 acres here and 5 acres there and 6 acres over there. Rather than burn one 20-acre unit.
Yeah.
Because as long as you can get it spaced out, and that way we know that, and there's a lot of good things, a lot of research that, you know, the Mississippi State's done, the bow range burning.
Just recently out of Auburn, that there was research done that if you reduce the canopy by 30% and then you apply prescribed fire, a thinning of 30%. That's really, really easy. So you have 70% canopy, 30% sunlight. You increase the amount of deer food per acre by 500%.
Yeah.
That ought to get your attention.
Yeah.
Like, again, and that's what we talked about early on, is like, you have to have sunlight. This is not necessarily an either or situation. If you want results, you've got to feed the system. And that is with sunlight. So a combination of cutting to some degree and burning, phenomenal results.
For sure.
So I don't know. I think that's a pretty dang good wrap up on burning in the timber, kind of a roundabout way to say that's essentially what we're looking for, how to do it, and hitting a lot of the key points. You got anything else to add there?
No, man. Not at all. I think hopefully there's some guys ramping up and getting ready for prescribed fire. Probably, we just got tagged today, but one of our clients here locally that is burning. So I know there's some guys doing it, and I'm enjoying seeing how many people are new to it that are getting out and doing it and having yes. fun with it. So it's very encouraging.
I know for a fact that both of the sites that we're going to, both Michigan and Alabama, either have burned in the past year or will be burning probably before we get there.
Awesome.
So there will be sites of multiple years of regeneration, fresh. I know in Alabama there was a growing season burn done in 2020, I believe it was September, October timeframe. So by July, it'll blow your mind. So
yeah.
If you guys want to see this, come see us at the workshops.
Yep. Awesome. So, well, Matt.
Appreciate it, guys.
Yep. We'll talk to everyone next week.
That's right. Yep. See ya.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.